province officer in charge. And let's just talk.
And he's in charge of all CIA operations.
All CIA operations, including covert operations.
Yes, he's supervisor of everything in that province, having to do with the CIA activities.
And yet, he comes from the FI branch.
Well, when they put these things together, he may not. He may have been drawn from maybe a covert operations branch guy and was made the province officer.
I see. Okay, because the liaison branch to the special branch technically was part of FI, not foreign intelligence, not CO, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so I was just wondering if within the station there might have been some feeling that one CIA officer shouldn't have authority over another who is operating in the province.
Oh no. This is one of those things that also becomes a debate throughout the history of the agency. But that really didn't enter in the best guy, by and large, the best guy in the province was chosen to be the province officer.
Okay.
When they brought about this integration.
Right. Okay. I see. So. You understand my questioning, because I'm looking at it organizationally, and I'm just.
But now this had nothing to do with Phoenix or ISAC or anything. This is strictly CIA activities at the time.
That's what I'm trying to understand, is where sometimes there's overlapping, and I understand it to just be on a province to province basis.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Now there's also a Phoenix region officer. He is not then the CIA region officer.
He could be.
The Phoenix regional coordinator could be.
Well, as a matter of fact, in at the beginning at any rate, most of the Phoenix coordinators were CIA roiks.
Right, okay. And then as military come in, they would just step back and let him have Phoenix
later. I was personally opposed to letting the military become dominant in these structures. Certainly at the beginning they were not.
Right.
As time went on, and as various operations phased down and this and that, as I understand, the military did become more and more predominant.
Yes.
And so you tell me that ultimately they were all military.
Ultimately they're all military.
Which is, I suppose, understandable.
Yeah. Well, especially as the CIA wanted to be out of it, I understand, at some point. Okay, just a few more clarifications. There is foreign intelligence, covert ops, and is there also counterespionage? Are those three separate divisions within a station?
Well,
or does I guess my question is, does counterespionage fall under one of the either covert ops or foreign intelligence?
No, it doesn't. Counterespionage is separate.
Okay.
Sometimes it's merged in with FI.
Okay.
Now, in our particular case, field operations, you see, Saigon was anomalous. There's no other station in the world like it.
Okay.
In our particular case, if you're working with the police special branch, you're working both positive intelligence programs, FI, but you're also working counter-espionage, counter-terrorism, whatever. Because the police, they don't have that distinction, and you're just working with the police, so you have to cover all of this.
Right. Okay. Now, first, I understand that the Vietnamese Military Security Service was their counter-espionage branch.
Yes, that's right. The same as the American Counterintelligence Corps.
Right. So, was it the American, 525th Military Intelligence Group that then worked with the MSS, not the CIA? Well, would the CIA have a liaison to it also?
No, it was military intelligence would have a liaison with the counterpart Marvin units.
Okay, but CIA would conduct its own counter-espionage within its own operations?
Yes.
And had no concern what was going on with Vietnamese?
Well, no, except as the National Police were right deep in the middle of this stuff.
Okay, which may...
The National Police, just as MI5 in England, or the FBI in this country, the National Police was a civilian counterintelligence service as well as intelligence.
And would it be the special branch that would have handled
the special branch? Yes, that's what I mean. Special branch.
Okay, all right, good.
As a matter of fact, special branch, I think, is a British term to start with.
That's right, and I understand it is roughly an equivalent to the American FBI, which conducts counterintelligence operations in the United States, trying to uncover subversives or spies or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Just trying to get pinned down some of the, because these are the things that I think are the most, in some instances, the most important things to understand.
Something we didn't even touch on yesterday, the fact that some of this stuff derived from, as a matter of fact, derived from the British experience in Malaysia, where the British had run a successful counterinsurgency operation.
Well, I imagine you must have consulted with Sir Robert Thompson, did you?
Oh, yeah. I think that he would talk to Secretary of State or Director of CIA or something.
Okay.
He's one of those stratospheric figures and who would have no impact on what was really going on.
Okay. All right. And Howard Stone was your chief in FI.
Yeah.
Who would have been chief of covert operations?
I don't remember.
Okay. Okay. It's not really important anyway for what I'm doing.
Well, it is. I mean, in the same sense that those people became part of the Phoenix operation.
Yes, okay. Because they were running the PRU, and then the PRU became the main match.
The RD cadres and several other. They had about four or five programs in province.
Yeah, so RD cadre would have come under covert ops.
Yeah.
Did you know Robert Eschbach?
No.
Who I believe was the chief of RD cadre in Vung Tau.
Okay. No.
Okay, then, just the role of John Monopoly, and you say in building the picks, as I understand
none
it.
None whatsoever.
Okay.
They had nothing to do with it, ever.
What was his role then?
John Monopoly was chief of the National Police. Section of USA.
Excluding Special Branch.
Excluding Special Branch.
Okay.
And John and I worked quite closely together for a number of months there.
In what capacity?
Well, he was... we both sat on the task force on the police field forces.
Okay.
We both sat on the interagency committee on the roles and missions.
Yeah, okay.
And we both worked on the country plan or the campaign plan or whatever. When RDW or whatever was set up in the fall of 1966, and the covert action groups and my group moved up to that USAID building. John Monopoly and I were right down the hall from each other.
Okay.
That was in that big station reorganization I mentioned at the end of 1966. And the whole field operations, both covert action and police special branch were more or less divorced from the station at that time.
Okay.
Went under Lou Lapham as the new deputy chief of station and chief of RDC.
Okay. How were funds distributed did you play a role in distributing funds to your province officers? To your region officers?
Well, no, I didn't hand him any money.
You were not the person?
We were every branch throughout the agency, when it comes budget time, has to prepare a budget request, which I did, which would include operating funds for the regions and provinces.
Okay.
You have to include funds for the construction of these digs and everything else.
Incidentally, did you hire a contractor to build all the picks, or was it done province by province?
It was done province by province. The station logistics and construction people actually handled that. I didn't go out and locate contractors and sign contracts.
I was wondering if it was an American contractor.
No. It was. We tried to get Vietnamese as much as possible, stay away from American contractors. But back to the budget question.
Okay.
I would have to request a budget every year, develop a budget every year for my needs,
mm-hmm.
and that budget would be approved or amended, as the case may be, through the budgetary process.
Is there a budget officer in the station?
Oh, yes.
There is, okay.
And then budget officer.
Yes.
There is a finance officer.
Finance.
There is a finance section and a chief of finance. He might not necessarily be the same person as a budget officer.
Okay.
In a narrow sense.
I understand, yeah.
You might have a comptroller in an organization.
Okay.
Who is separate from and distinct from the finance office and the budget.
Okay.
And when I became later the so-called plans officer for the Soviet division,
mm-hmm.
I was not only the plans officer, I was also the comptroller for the division.
Okay.
And as comptroller, I would prepare budgets, not the finance officer.
Okay. And did you use...
Back to Saigon, I'd get my appropriation, and then the guys would get their region and province officers would get their allocations of money,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd have that authorization to draw that money from a finance officer. I mean, you're getting down into some fairly detailed mechanics there.
That's okay. I was wondering if you took that model and applied it to Phoenix, the way the agency...
No.
In terms of getting money to Phoenix to build the PIOX and the DIOX and all that stuff. I was wondering if the system by which you built the PICS was the same system by which you built the PIOX and the DIOX.
What's a PIOX?
Province Intelligence Operations Coordinating Center.
Okay.
Those are the
big... I don't know where that money would come from. Probably most of it would come from... Cords may have had his own appropriation.
Okay.
Money, something like that, normally would come from the USAID element.
Okay.
And if it didn't come from USAID, it would come from the military. The military were throwing in lots
okay.
of money. So, or it may be that the military and USAID might share it.
Okay.
But I have no knowledge whatsoever of how those things were financed.
Of how the PIOX and the DIOX,
yeah.
Okay. But the PICS were... Right from the CIA.
Special branch facilities. As a matter
okay.
of fact, there was a police special branch that would, as I recall, they'd buy the property or we'd pick the property out and buy it and then give it to the police
okay.
or whatever. But in any event, it became a facility of the National Police
okay.
under the direction of a special branch in a province.
Okay. How did you and John Monopoly share authority over a special branch? Did he just leave it alone to you?
We didn't share it at all. I had authority over a special branch. He had nothing to do with special branch.
In terms of funding of money coming to the Vietnamese in special branch?
Well, their special branch salaries and all that would just be part of the general police budget,
mm-hmm.
which would be USAID's problem.
Okay.
But that had nothing to do with anything. I mean, that was a Vietnamese problem.
Okay.
And whatever subsidy that USA provided, that was that.
Okay.
We provided our own subsidies in different ways. We built the PICS, we paid for them. We paid for special training for the particular police. We did not pay the salary of a PSP man.
I see. See, that's...
The National Police would pay his salary, and
mm-hmm.
USAID may or may not have subsidized that salary through the normal police channel.
I interviewed a Vietnamese gentleman who was high-ranking in Special Branch, and he said that his biggest problem was not getting the resources he needed from the National Police.
That's true. That's true.
But he said that would have been the same. That was the same throughout the government.
That's true. Everybody.
Right. Yeah. He just was complaining that he didn't have enough money for his
right.
budget. Okay. The last thing that I wanted to make sure I covered was penetrations, the third part. There was informant program, there was PICs, and then there's penetrations, and we didn't cover that, and I'd like to know a little bit about that.
Okay, there's not a whole lot to say. The national, the special branch people were encouraged to assign people to the case officers to penetration type operations. And our own people, of course, were, they would support the special branch, once again, a question of training, perhaps, case training, case officers, in the targeting and development of penetration agents. Or our people would, if the opportunities would come their way, would generate their own operations, and so that we would have a unilateral penetration.
Right,
into the VC.
Okay. Without your counterparts knowing.
Without the counterparts knowing about it. Yeah. Okay. These things were, for the most part, low grade, low level. But occasionally you might, we had some people on the payroll as penetration agents, who knows, at district level. And as I recall, we had three or four province level. VC province level.
Right.
Which was fairly high up.
Okay.
But the main problem in all of those cases was gaining access to these people and communication with them once you had a relationship.
Okay.
Anything in the Far East operates primarily by family.
Mm-hmm.
So the only opportunity of getting something like that would be through relatives who were accessible to you.
Right, you and I know that many families had been split.
Many families are split, but that didn't mean that they didn't work across the lines. So there were certain opportunities. I had developed leads out of the prisoner debriefings, Chu Hoy debriefings, various other, perhaps some captured documents of one sort or another.
Okay.
Or perhaps somebody would have a walk-in, somebody would come in and say, my brother is thus and such up in the district committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd start working on that situation.
Okay, very good.
And we had some of them that, as I recall, they were fairly good. I mean, when I say that, I mean that their information checked out. We were mainly interested in movements and activities of the district and province or Kassam cadres.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kassam people might come around to on an inspection tour or on an indoctrination mission or something. Or there might be a major political conference where you have a number of province cadre and Kassam cadre get together for something. Now, this is the kind of thing that we'd like to go after.
Militarily?
Or however we could.
Yeah,
it was usually militarily. Hopefully artillery, if you could reach it.
Yeah. Well, I understand that from some people in ASA that I talked with, that their job was trying to pinpoint electronically the location of Kassam at any particular time.
That was that's right. The ASA activities, of course, both sides were running enormous combat operations.
Yeah.
And your communications intelligence breaks down into two major categories. Your your decrypted communications. You may or may not succeed in doing, and your so-called traffic analysis.
Okay.
Your traffic analysis is going to be radio direction finding, location of units, a lot of your military, tactical military intelligence is so-called SIGINT. Sometimes that's called signals intelligence rather. That's British transient. We usually call it communication intelligence. But yeah, they were always trying to track down Cosmo and everything else that was going on over there. But the VC were doing the same thing to us.
Yeah, Lions.
And the North Vietnamese had a very elaborate communication intelligence operation run by their own people, North Vietnamese, down to a district level in the South Vietnam.
No, I understand that they would give one guy a battalion type radio and have him walk from somewhere south towards Saigon to make the Americans think a battalion was actually moving in force to a particular point.
There may have been some signal deception of that type. Yeah. I don't recall very much of that sort of thing. It's perfectly possible. But the North Vietnamese had a highly sophisticated communication intelligence operation going, and the Russians and the Chinese Communists.
And these are attempting to tap into.
And these are all radio intercepts.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, where this became such a major threat was that nothing happened in Vietnam that was not coordinated. Most of that coordination would take place by radio. So you might be bringing a B-52 bomber strike in from Guam, and that thing would be on the radio 18 to 24 hours before the actual strike.
Yeah.
And the VC, as we discovered, knew all about these things. There was no military operation, no major airstrike in that country, as far as I'm concerned, that the VC did not know about it almost as soon as it was planned.
Very interesting. And this is not through.
No, not only that.
This is not through people telling people.
This is communication intelligence. We also learned subsequently. Well, what happened was two sergeants out in Hanoi sat down with adding machines, and they intercepted and successfully decrypted Strategic Air Command operational communications. SAC communications, so that everything in and out of Guam was readable. Now, if these guys could do it, the Russians could do it too. As a matter of fact, we learned sometime, and I don't remember exactly how or when, that in fact, yes, the Russians were reading all of our SAC traffic throughout this whole business. And they, of course, were giving it to the
And that's all the B-52s, the
what?
SAC, is that's B-52s.
Those are B-52s, yeah. Yeah, all the B-52s, okay. Strategic Air Command. But everything else is...
From Guam and aircraft carriers and...
Carriers would be Navy.
Okay.
They had nothing to do with SAC.
Okay.
That SAC was just Air Force.
Air Force. Okay. 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 Very good.
But once again, this is... In one obscure way or another, this is all in the public domain.
Yeah.
But still, it's never really been put together in terms of the scandal that it really was.
Okay.
And... No matter what you wrote in Washington or in Saigon, you could never get anybody to take action in this kind of thing. It was incredibly frustrating.
Okay. I now have some notes that I took from Ralph Johnson's dissertation, which, unless you want to show me the documents now, do you want to do some more taping, at least maybe to the end of this tape?
Today we're going to have to break off no later than 3:30.
Okay, so why don't I, do you think maybe an hour for them? Maybe longer? Maybe we should do them now? Let me go to the end of this tape.
Okay, let's go to the end of this tape, and then we can one or two of the key ones, and then whatever else. We'll see.
Brickman says, Johnson says, Comer assigned Brickham to the CIA staffed RevDev component of OCL.
Comer. Say that again.
Okay. Comer assigned Brickham to the CIA-staffed RevDev component of OCO.
I was already there before Comer came out of that.
Okay.
So that Comer had nothing to do with that assignment. I don't know. I don't know where Ralph got that idea. I didn't tell him that.
Okay. But RevDev then was...
Revolutionary Development, RV. That was when the...
That's Lou...
Lou Lappin.
Okay. So was he, in a sense, your boss for that period?
Yeah, he became my boss. I moved over from Howard Stone's jurisdiction over to Lou Lappin's jurisdiction.
All right.
I answered to him. That was my chain of command.
Okay, and then actually, the next, all my next questions really are about attack on the VCI. So, attack against the VCI. So, perhaps if that document is...
Yeah, okay, well, let's turn that thing off. And then for the record, I want to make clear what a truly remarkable group of people the Air America pilots were, the entire Air America operation. These fellows were bush pilots, a lot of them. Some of them were mercenaries, some of them were old crop dusters, some of them were, came from Alaska. As pilots in light aircraft and in STOL aircraft, they were absolutely magnificent. They were without blood. They had the total courage. They would go where you told them, regardless of circumstances. At one time, in trying to come into way, we had 100% fog, visibility about 30 feet. And our pilot attempted twice to make a landing there, purely on his knowledge of the locality and the field, of where the field was and what was in the way. And finally he called me up to say that he was having a little difficulty coming in here, but what did I want him to do, since I was the one in charge? Should we go in there and land, or should we go home? So I said, well, let's make one more try, but carefully. And so sure enough, he did. And we came close enough that we saw the end of the landing strip, but we were too far along. We had to go back up and around. And I made the decision at that time to go back home. But other occasions, in total ignorance of what was existing on the ground, and we had no reason to believe that hostile forces were not waiting for us on landing, two separate occasions, those pilots simply took our plane in there and waited for us until we were ready to leave and tell them what to do. And as I said at the beginning of this little aside, that they are truly magnificent group of people who have never had the recognition they deserve.
Well, I'd very much like to talk to one or two of them.